We'll get the call the meeting to order for House or State Government Finance. We don't have minutes today that something had to be corrected, so we're going to do those tomorrow. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members.
And I'll move House File, can't even talk this morning, 1603 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And there's an amendment here, and I this is my amendment. And I'm going to move the A12 amendment, members. And what this is there's a piece in here from Representative Lucero. Am I right with that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero brought this portion of 1603 forward.
And in the bill, there's language for it can be spent on this, but not limited to this. And as we had in a previous bill, we had some questions about that. And so I'm going to take that language out, and that's basically what this amendment does. It just takes out the language, but not limited to, on page 53, if you want to follow in the, it's about security, being able to spend non-campaign funds on security, and the language that's in the bill is, it says, including but not limited to home security cameras, home security systems, and identity theft monitoring systems, and we're taking out the language, including but not limited to. And the reason for that is again, we had that discussion on a previous bill that was some objection on the HAVA bill that was that, and there's also the fact that some people came to me and wondering if security could be considered buying a gun with their campaign money. And so having that language in there, I don't want to open this up for other issues. So that's what the amendment does. So members, I move the A12 amendment. Any more questions? If not, all in favor of the A12 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you'd like, I can quickly run through the synopsis and talk about the sections of the bill.
Okay. You can proceed.
Okay. Well, first off, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for taking the time to consider 1603. What I'll do is I'll just go through your I hope that you all have the spreadsheet which has all the different topic areas. So in sections 1 and 8 we have the topic of automatic voter registration, and that was from House File 45. In section 2 we have school board vacancies, and that was House File 839. In sections 3, 35, and 70 was transit service on election day, and that was House File 489. In sections 4, 6, 9, 36, 69, and 71, restoration of voting rights, which was House File 40. In sections 5, 10 through 12, 15, 19, 20, 22 through 31, 58, 59 and 73 through 75 was early voting. In sections 13, 16, 17, and 21 was permanent absentee voters. In section 7, 36, 63 through 67 was presidential national primary. In sections 14 and 34 were electronic transmission of absentee voting material. In sections 18 was in-person absentee voting locations. In sections 32, 38, 55, 56, and 60, electronic voting systems. In sections 33 was elections by mail. In section 37, was assisting voters in a polling place. Sections 39 through 43, special elections timeline. Sections 44 through 54, 57, 59, 61, and 62 was ranked choice voting. in the first article, section 68, was national popular vote interstate compact. In section 72 was the Help American Voter Act election security appropriation. In article 2 of 1603, sections 1 through 9, 11 through 14, 16 through 21, 26 and 27, was regarding Hennepin County elections. In section 6 of that article was expressly advocating. Sections 10 was non-campaign disbursement for security-related expenses, which was House File 673 by Lucero. Sections 15, 20, 20 through 25, electioneering communications, which was House File 2050. And then Article 3 was regarding census and redistricting. Sections 1 and 6, Redistricting Advisory Commission, that was House File 1605. Also House File 1605, in Section 2, were districting principles. In Section 3, House File 1605, were the Legislative Commission duties related to redistricting. Section 4 of 1605 was redistricting of local governments. And Section 5 was House File 2059, and that was access to multi-unit residential facilities.
That's the bill
in a nutshell, but of course there's a lot more substance to it than just that.
We're going to start with public testimony, and then we're going to leave time at the end. We'll take public testimony till about 10 minutes to 9, and then we'll have questions after that. So, members, on my list here, I have, starting with the Secretary of State, Steve Simon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thanks for your time and attention. I'm not here to talk about everything in the bill. I just want to focus on four things in particular and happy to stand for questions and answer any concerns people have about them. First, I want to talk about the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, appropriation here. As many of you know, there's already a bill, a separate bill right now that's frankly languishing in conference committee. Many of you are familiar with this issue. In 2016, Minnesota was one of the 21 states that was targeted, whose election system was targeted by a foreign government. Fortunately, nothing bad happened in Minnesota. In two states, something bad did happen. In Arizona and Illinois, there was a breach, there was an infiltration, and it demonstrated just how vulnerable our systems can be. So to their credit, the president and Congress last year stepped up, provided election security money for the states. Our share was $6.6 million. It came to us about a year ago. But there's an extra step in Minnesota. We're one of about five states where the extra step is that the state legislature must sign off on our use of that money. Even though it's not state money, it's federal money that comes from the federal treasury, we're one of the few states where the state has to sign off on that. That didn't happen at the end of last session, making us the only state in the country not to have any of its election money in time for the 2018 election, and that's what it was intended for, at least primarily and initially. So going into this session, both legislative leaders, Speaker Hortman and Majority Leader Gazelka, named this explicitly and specifically in multiple interviews with multiple sources as something that could and should get done early this session, that it was low-hanging fruit, that it was not a partisan issue, and here we are 3 months into session and it hasn't gotten done yet. The conference committee, I think it's fair to say, is languishing. I'm not interested today in pointing fingers about who's responsible or not, except to say that in the House, this has not at all been a partisan issue. And I want to call out some members who have been particularly helpful, Representative Nash, Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Vogel, Leader Doubt, people who on a bipartisan basis have been very helpful in understanding this issue and that this is an issue of national security. So. This is, I presume, in this bill because the conference committee is languishing for a number of reasons that I don't think we need to talk about here today. but it's important to recognize. So that is a huge priority. I will just say this, and I know Representative Nash and Representatives Nash and Bogle are familiar with this. One of the cornerstones of the use of this money, the $6.6 million, is the effort and the project to modernize and resecure and recode our statewide voter registration system. That is a four-year project. We had 5 years to spend the money as of last March 23rd. You can do the math. We're now under 4 years left to spend the money, and the Cornerstone project will take 4 years. So we're really up against it right now, and we have a target on our back. We're the only state in America not to get this money, and that's unfortunate. So that's why that's in this bill, and it's a matter of some real urgency here, particularly as to that project, but generally speaking as well. And thank you as well, Mr. Chair, obviously, for your leadership, and you're on that conference committee as well. The second issue I wanted to highlight for members is the improvements to the presidential nominating primary. And just a quick bit of history. Those of you who were here then know some of this because you lived it. But in 2016, the legislature, many of you, decided to move us from a caucus state for presidential nominating purposes to a primary state beginning in 2020. We're going to be a hybrid state. We're going to keep caucuses for every other purpose, for legislative support for every other office, for platform, for everything else. But for this one contest, President of the United States, obviously only every 4 years, we're going to take that out separately. And the legislature wanted there to be a real election, not slips of scratch paper in the junior high gymnasium or anything like that anymore, but a real election with real election judges in real polling places. So that was the decision that was made by the 2016 legislature. For a lot of reasons, we can go over whether that was right or wrong, but for a lot of reasons there was broad support. But the problem from my vantage point, and from the vantage point more importantly of a lot of people around the state, is that the way the law was written was to make it so that there will be multiple ballots in the 2020 contest. It's March 3rd of next year, Super Tuesday. One ballot for each major party that chooses to field presidential candidates. But here's the difficulty. The ballot that you choose as a voter, whether it's a DFL ballot, the Republican ballot, or potentially the one of the ballots from one of the two marijuana legalization parties, which are now major parties in Minnesota, the identity of the ballot that you choose, not the candidate, obviously, but the ballot that you choose will be public. It will be a public record, publicly available and gettable by anyone who comes up with the $46 fee and does it for a proper purpose. And that means that your neighbor, your employer, anyone else out there can know which party you chose. So this is sort of a backdoor party registration system, and I would argue that it's worse than a party registration system, which we've never had since statehood, and it's worse in the sense that in states that register by party, and many of you know of those states, maybe you've lived in those states, in those states, there is always an option to register as independent or unaffiliated. That won't exist next March 3rd. In other words, if you want to participate, you've got to pick a team, and that team will follow you for years, meaning you will be associated with that team, whether it was for that election or not. That is a backdoor party registration system, and I know that Minnesotans, because I've heard from many of them around the state, they do not and will not like a backdoor party registration. And there are certain people in professions, just think about it, whether it's legislative staff here at the legislature, or whether it's members of the media, or members of the clergy, or school administrators, or judges, or others you can well imagine, who will simply not participate because their occupations demand that they be sort of above the partisan fray. And then there are everyday citizens, regardless of their walk of life or occupation, who will really object strongly to being sort of typecast or associated with one party or another, and will not participate, and maybe worse, will participate and find out only afterwards that that was the rule, despite all of our best intentions of getting that information out there, and they'll be really distressed about that. So one major feature, there are others though, but one major one in this bill would be to simply say that this is not public information. There will still be the separate ballots. That's something apparently that the national parties are requiring. In a perfect world, I would support a voter having to sign on the dotted line with any party. That I think is the best solution. But practically speaking, what this bill does is make sure that it's not a public record. So that's the key part of that provision. The next one I just want to highlight is the automatic voter registration provision, and some of you have been on the committees already and heard this. This has had a number of committee stops, but some of you are new to the issue here in terms of committee assignments. And what I always strain to emphasize is that that term, automatic voter registration, while it sounds sweeping and bold and all the rest, in some senses there's less there than meets the eye. And here's what I mean. In Minnesota, we have a motor voter law, as many of you know. Most states do. You go in, you take the iChart test, you get your driver's license or renew it, and there's always a box on that form, if you've ever noticed. And the box says, check this box if you want to also be registered to vote, because it's the same information you're providing for the driver's license renewal that would be used to register you to vote. And all this bill would do is reverse that presumption. Same process, same iChart test, same building, same form, same box. Only under the box, it just says, check here if you don't want to be registered. So I can't say A to Z would be unchanged, but I can say B to Z would be unchanged. Only changes step A. All the normal filtering, processing, screening, everything is exactly the same. So it's a sweeping, bold-sounding title, automatic voter registration, but there's nothing really automatic about it. Real human beings are still doing what they always have done. But it is a reform that many states, red states, blue states, all states in between have adopted, and it makes for cleaner, better data. It makes our system, I think, more secure than it is right now, because you're getting people in the system earlier and you can do the filtering and screening and checking earlier. And that's why I suspect many states have turned to it. The final thing, and then I'm happy to stand for any questions that I just want to highlight, and many of you, again, are familiar with this because it's had multiple committee stops, is restoration of voting rights for those who have left prison behind. This is something that has real national momentum in other states, whether it's Iowa, North Dakota, which now has this rule, Florida, and others. And I use the example of Florida just from a political standpoint, since there are many political animals in this room. You know, Florida this last election had a recount in its governor's race, a recount in its U.S. Senate race. This is a 50-50 knockdown, drag-out state, yet this issue was on the ballot and it got 61%. That doesn't compel a result here in Minnesota. I'm just trying to demonstrate that across the country there is a real movement in this direction of saying that if you've done the time and someone somewhere has determined that you're good enough and safe enough to be out among the rest of us, it's in everyone's interest, not just that person's interest, but all of our interest, that that person is sort of part of the team and feels invested in the system so that they don't reoffend. And for that reason and many other reasons, I support restoring that right for people who have left prison behind in Minnesota. So those are four things I just wanted to highlight, but I'm happy to stand for any questions or take any feedback or pushback on any of this. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Well, thank you, Secretary Simon. Can you hang around a little bit? Because I'd like to get the testimony out of the way, and then, like I said, questions after that.
Sure.
Thank you. The next person I have on my list is Ann Lindstrom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ann Lindstrom with the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent 833 of Minnesota's 853 cities. We support the bill in total, but there's a few things that I just like to highlight in the Elections Administration article, and I want to thank Chair Dean for authoring the bill. I won't belabor the points that Secretary Simon has already made because he, of course, not surprisingly, more comprehensively and eloquently summarized them than I can. But I do want to draw attention to the two things, the presidential nomination primary process and the HAVA funding issues. And I think it's important to be clear that while I want to stress these points, the House has really led on these issues. The House has moved the legislation, the HAVA funding has been supported in the full amount in a bipartisan manner, but the presidential nomination primary is causing our elections administrators great consternation and anxiety if it doesn't get changed this session. So just to reiterate, when somebody goes in to participate, whatever party they align themselves with will be public information. And I think, you know, the way that our elections administrators think about it is that it's our administrators and it's our judges who will inform Minnesotans of that unfortunate reality and will therefore have to, as I like to say, face the ire I'm anticipating of those who are choosing to participate. And then, you know, not to be too hyperbolic about it, but I have concerns and we as an organization have concerns about how that impacts Minnesotans going forward in their participation in any type of election, whether it's the presidential nomination party, which is not an election, nobody is being elected, or the state general primary, or any other type of election that's being conducted by locals. So we really ask again that the legislature move to improve that process before the primary is conducted. And the second one is the Help America Vote Act funding and full access to that. And thank you again to the House for being strong leaders on that. As we, I'm hearing more and more from our cities who are, to be honest, just sort of confused why that isn't happening and why we're not getting rolling on it. It's, I would argue for cities, it's a bit of a customer experience concern for them, because again, it's our administrators who respond to voters, and if voters have concerns that Minnesota isn't leading and isn't moving quickly to secure our election cybersecurity, then they will most likely be talking to our city clerks and our election judges about their concerns about our systems. And then just a few other ones, and then I will be done testifying. The third one is the mail balloting provisions, and I want to thank Representative Hewitt is the one who originally authored the bill that will allow cities in the metro with less than 400 registered voters to conduct elections by mail balloting. Right now there is an arbitrary restriction on the metro area. Cities across the state that have 400 registered voters or less have the authority to conduct elections by mail. The other one is the provisions regarding ranked choice voting. The League of Minnesota Cities doesn't have a specific policy in support of ranked choice voting, but we do have a policy in support of statutory cities being able to look at that process and see if it makes the most sense for them. As a reminder, in Minnesota, again, there's 853 cities, and 107 of them are charter cities. So there are a lot of cities that right now don't have the statutory authority to look at ranked choice voting. So in an effort to treat all of our cities fairly, we would like that authority to be extended to them. And we think it's important that there are statewide policies and provisions guiding that process so that voters across the state understand how it works maybe a bit better. The fifth one are the early voting provisions. And, you know, that one is very much, again, an issue of providing the best possible experience to voters. So right now, voters think that we have an early voting system, as you know. So they go into their polling place and are confused when they have to fill out an application for an absentee ballot. And I think more concerning than that administrative process is that they watch their ballot get folded into envelopes and put in storage before they leave the polling place. And I think that our elections administrators have heard from voters that they would like to be able to put their ballot right into the tabulator. The language allows a voter to choose to put their ballot into envelopes because there continues to be concern about clawback provisions. So there are options for voters to do what they feel most comfortable with, which I think is important, and ultimately that's the goal, is to make sure that voters are having the best possible experience. And then the last one that I'll just mention is the restoration of voting rights for those convicted of felonies. The League has long had a policy in support of this because it is our election judges who administer the challenges. And that's just, frankly, no matter how much training is done, not something that election judges particularly enjoy or will ever be comfortable administering. And we recently, our cities have revised our policy that says, in addition to once not incarcerated, if someone is serving the entire term of their felony sentence within their community, their ability to vote is never taken from them. So if you're standing in front of an election judge, you're able to vote, is what our policy says. With that, I'll conclude my comments. I can answer any questions. And thank you again for allowing me to testify.
Well, thank you. And again, can you hang around so we'll do the questions at the end? Thank you. Next, I have Matt Hilgart. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. And I'll try to be brief just because I think Ms. Lindstrom and the Secretary of State covered most of what we are also in support of. The four main issues that are on AMC's platform are the restoration of felon voting rights, fixing the data privacy concerns that were outlined by the Secretary of State regarding the presidential primary, support for the mail balloting threshold increases for all cities under 400, regardless of geographic location, and then the HABA money. And I'll just touch on two of these issues. As Ms. Lindstrom pointed out, the presidential primary concerns were probably single-handedly the most popular issue that was brought before our annual conference in December. It started with a couple commissioners with going around to members saying, did you know that this information could be public, to our entire membership at the end of the conference approaching staff, other commissioners saying, how could this be possible? And so I think adding to what the Secretary of State and Ms. Lindstrom mentioned, there are large concerns about what this will do to voter participation, but also what this will do to frontline county and city staff that are administering the elections. Lastly, the HAVA full funding. We appreciate the House's efforts to push this forward. AMC was part of the working group that the Secretary of State established in interim, and we were proud with the results of that, and it is unanimously supported by our membership. So in closing, I want to thank Chair Dean for his work on this bill. We are supportive, and also for the work of bipartisan members who came together to push many of these measures forward in this bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And next I have Troy Olson. I didn't see Troy. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I believe he's currently testifying in Texas, so he might show up at some point.
If he shows up at some time, we'll put him back on the list. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak on this bill? Yep. One at a time. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kimberly Lewis. I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and we just wanted to briefly say thank you on behalf of all 332 districts in the state for including school board vacancy, which is, I believe, Representative Hewitt's bill that's in Section 2 of Article 1. It's one of the things that our school board members find very complex, very high cost, and with very low voter turnout, it's been an issue for them across the state. So we really, really do appreciate that inclusion there. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Next. And again, state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Deborah Zavosik. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
You want to spell your last name?
Oh, sure. I often do. Z-V-O-S-E-C.
Good Irish name.
My husband's name is Smith, and people often wonder why I haven't taken his. I just am here as a citizen, as a voter, as a volunteer, who is very concerned with all of these issues. My primary concern is redistricting reform, and I appreciate the presence of HF 1605 in this bill. Incredibly important. As the State Government Finance Committee, it matters here that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce puts redistricting reform as one of its priorities and specifically recommends an advisory commission. And it seems to me that this lays the fundamental groundwork upon which commerce, education, community participation lies for so many of us everyday Minnesotans when we go to the polls, because we know that the districts are fairly drawn. And then, of course, all of the other issues that are contained in this bill are critical as well once people have the districts to which they go to vote, including restoration of the vote for felons and privacy and all of the other issues contained in here. So I just wanted to urge all of you, as a member of the public, it's often hard to follow the process. I had no idea I would be sitting here when I came in this morning. But it's very important to us, and so I urge transparency and fairness and bipartisanship, because I think we all really want that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next. Again, state your name for the tape, and then you can begin proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Diane Steen-Hinderly, and I'm from Ryan Winkler's area, and I don't see him here, but I'm going to mention something about his district later on. I'm wearing a Norwegian sweater, ski sweater, and I'm inspired to come here today because of two big commentary pieces in yesterday's Star Tribune saying what we saw in Norway, a model for Minnesota, is the top one. And then a Norwegian himself, an Ole Andreasen, wrote the bottom about Nordic policies. And Norway is the most prosperous and happy nation on Earth, according to the United Nations and other indices. And I'm here to explore why that is. And one of my bona fides, not just because I'm 100% Norwegian-American, but my family got here before 1880, so we're old pioneers. And my grandpa's cousin was the secretary to Norway's prime minister for quite a while, and then she was appointed to be administrator of the king's summer palace in Bergen, a post she held for 25 years. But Norway, it's not what these two articles said, that something personal about Norwegian citizens or their traits as a nation, like trusting each other. But they don't mention that there's a structural factor. The Vikings were brutal people. They just went across the northern hemisphere and slaughtered residents of other nations. And even internally, they were very hostile. St. Olaf, who I went to St. Olaf College, named after him in Northfield, and they were internally very hostile. He was killed when he tried to unite Norway. They had a terrible time becoming one nation. And the structural thing that has happened since then is that they have advanced election or voting systems like much of Europe. And an example is in the Benelux countries, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, northwest, that's in the northwest of mainland Europe. And Representative Winkler lived there for one or two years. I was hoping he would be here. But at a community meeting in St. Louis Park, I sat next to a lady who I recognized her accent as a Northern European, and she looked about 40 years old, so I know she had voted probably many times. And I asked her, I said, okay, when you voted over there, did you do things like one, two, three, and have what we called rankings? And she said, oh, yeah, we one, two, three, on, up, we do that all the time. So the key is to update the mathematics. So it's called ranked choice voting over here. We used to call it instant runoff voting in Minnesota, but now it's called RCV. And the meme that it's confusing is erroneous, because I called my son's elementary school, Peter Hobart. I wish that Brian was here. He could try it himself, to say, when you start teaching ranking? And they said, we don't have to. They come here knowing how to do that already because of learning it in preschool. So any new thing, you have to kind of get familiar with it, but that's not that it's confusing. And I really think this is very necessary for a responsive democracy, to put this simple change that a preschooler can understand into our system. So thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you. Anybody else? Welcome to the committee. Again, state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jason Flores. I'm the State Director for Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota. On behalf of our activists across the state, I urge you to vote no on the portions of this bill that originated in House File 2050 related to donor disclosure. Americans for Prosperity stands firmly in support of the right of all Americans to participate in civic engagement, and this legislation would only limit discourse and undermine free speech. The provisions from House File 2050 would chill protected speech by mandating the disclosure of donors who give to organizations to support their general missions. These donors may never see, hear, or be aware of the communications that this bill seeks to regulate, but who may nevertheless be associated with them. For example, someone gives to an organization because of the work they do in criminal justice reform, this provision would force them to take ownership of everything the organization is involved in. Donors will be deterred from donating to good causes for fear that their names may end up on a government registry because those organizations took positions on legislation or on issues, positions with which those donors might even disagree. Transparency is good for government accountability and for oversight, but individuals have a right to privacy. Just as Americans have the right to cast ballots in private, we have the right to support causes, join groups, and make donations without being monitored by the government. History shows that these very freedoms protect minority voices, those fighting against injustices entrenched in the status quo. And there's a long tradition in the U.S., going all the way back to our founding, of anonymous philanthropy, as well as anonymous writing on matters of public interest. When Alabama tried to force the NAACP to reveal its member list during Jim Crow, the Supreme Court held that the First Amendment protects private associations from being exposed to threats, intimidation, and to violence. Even today, people who have made even modest donations to groups that have expressed unpopular views have lost their jobs and faced harassment when their affiliations were leaked. Those in power shouldn't force individuals to register their beliefs, their donations, or their associations. The requirement to disclose donors' names puts their safety at risk and will result in a country that allows government-facilitated intimidation to control our legislative process and public discourse. Too often, these types of requirements are designed to make it harder to critique those in power and shields the political class from the voices of everyday citizens who just want to make their viewpoints known to their elected officials. While the lobbyists and well-connected will still find a way to play their inside game, everyday citizens who want to make their voices heard on issues they care about will have that voice taken away. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns behind those sections of the bill here today.
Thank you. Next. And again, state your name for the tape.
Good morning. My name is Catherine Engel. Good morning to the chair and to the members. I'm here particularly for the redistricting reform, 1605. The 1605 is the best bill we have to ensure bipartisan, fair, inclusive representation in voting. The other law bill that I'm particularly concerned with is voter restoration. There are over 50,000 Minnesotans that are currently disenfranchised and punished unnecessarily. It's also confusing. When I was volunteering and door knocking for the past elections, I came across two young men who lived right across from a voting place, and they were both maybe late 20s. One of them said, "I can't vote. I'm a felon." I said, "Are you still on paper?" He said, "No." I said, "Then you're allowed to vote." So there's even confusion with people who are allowed to vote. So I strongly encourage you to pass this bill, 1603, this omnibus bill, to include fair voting laws, both in redistricting and in restoration of voting rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Anybody else that needs to speak on this bill? If not, Representative Long, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was for the Secretary of State, if he's still available.
Secretary Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. So the League of Minnesota Cities stated that the cities are confused as to why the HAPA funding hasn't become available. I share their confusion, as I think do many Minnesotans. The House position is pretty clear. In a bipartisan vote, we said that the entirety of the money that Congress has appropriated, not the state, but Congress has appropriated to us, should be available immediately to make sure that we're protecting our elections. So I'm just curious what the holdup is in conference. I'm not on the conference committee, and I haven't had a chance to follow it, and you know why this is so hard. It's mind-boggling to me that we haven't been able to get this done yet.
Secretary Simon, I'm on the conference committee. I'm confused too, but Secretary Simon.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Long. Well, let me just start by saying what I said earlier, because I think it's important that we all have this fundamental understanding. This is not a partisan issue. It's not at all a partisan issue. It's not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. It's a national security issue. All the intelligence agencies unanimously and repeatedly and recently have warned us that what happened in 2016, a foreign government attempting to access our election system in multiple states, including Minnesota, is very likely to happen again in 2020, originating from one government, but perhaps multiple governments. So don't take my word for it. Ask the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, who has called this an attack and who has sounded the alarm repeatedly. So it's not my telling of the events, it's hers. So this is a bipartisan issue, and again, the members I mentioned earlier, some of whom are in this room, deserve a lot of credit. for making this what it ought to be, which is a nonpartisan issue. It's more of an institutional issue here between the House and the Senate. I wouldn't call it a partisan issue between Democrats and Republicans because so many in this room, I'm sure almost everyone in this room, off the House floor voted for this. And people that I mentioned behind the scenes have been extraordinarily helpful, not just this year, but going back a number of years. So I thank them. So why is the conference committee stalled? It's hard for me to say. And I would also defer to others on the conference committee, including you, Mr. Chair, but it's very difficult to say. This is being slow-walked in service of maybe some other grander strategy. And I certainly understand that. I served among many of you here for 10 years. I'm not new to the idea of holding things up until the end of session, so it's trade bait for something. But what I have said repeatedly and will repeat here is that is a very dangerous game. If you want to trade the security of our election system for a provision in the tax bill or a bonding project or something else at the end of session when three people in the room are making the decision, you're really rolling the dice. I mentioned the one project, the Cornerstone project, which is the four-year project. We've got less than 4 years to spend the money. So it's terribly important that we get that. The Senate has said multiple times that it is delaying or not responding to House offers because it wants to do some sort of vetting. Committee deadlines are over. We've had committee hearings in the Senate Committee of Jurisdiction. I offered to make not only myself available, but our entire IT staff available, and I didn't even have to be in the room. If senators or anyone from the Senate wanted to meet with our IT people, and I could be somewhere totally different, I don't have to be there, and just talk with them about the nuts and bolts of the importance of this, they could do it. So far, they haven't identified a single thing that they disapprove of or disagree with in terms of our plan to spend the money. And I will note, just for the record, as many of you know, that our office, having not received the money at the end of last session, we didn't sulk, we didn't mope. Instead, what we did is we convened a working group, and many people of both parties in this room were part of that working group over the interim. We met several times. Staff and members from all four legislative caucuses were invited to participate, and almost all did. We had people from all levels of government, townships, cities, counties. We had IT experts. We had people from the disability community and others. And we met over the interim, including in five different subcommittees that broke out and did their own separate work to come up with a menu or a plan to spend this money. And so far, no one in the Senate that I know of has identified a single part of that report or that plan, which has been on their desks since late November of last year, that they disagree with, nothing that they think we should do more of or less of. So this certainly looks to me like a delay tactic, and all I'm saying is that's a very dangerous game to play. I get how it works around here, but there has to be an exception at some point for national security, and that's what this is.
Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, Secretary Simon, when did the money first become available to Minnesota?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and members and Representative Long, it became available to us about a year ago, and I just want to underscore that we are the only state in America now. And this has been the case since last year. We're the only state in America not to receive any of that money.
Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, just so there's been a year to have a conversation about how we're going to use the money. You did a full process over the summer. You've had a public plan since November. We're the only state out there that hasn't used this money. And you have projects that are, if we don't get the funding to you soon, we may not be able to spend the money in time. Is that about right?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, that's correct. And let me just underscore one other thing, because I've been asked, and it's a logical question, I asked the same question. Some people have said, well, this four-year project that's so important, and it is, can't you do it in shorter than 4 years? If you hired double the people, could you do it in 2 years? That kind of thing. And someone the other day offered to me an analogy. It's a delicate one, but I think a good one. They likened it to, and some of you who are IT professionals or have this background can back me up on this, but someone I just talked to who's with a major Fortune 500 company the other day who does cybersecurity said it's sort of like a pregnancy. You can't say, hey, if we got more people involved, could we do it in 4.5 months instead of 9 months? You can't do that. Now, I'm simplifying it, and maybe Representative Nash and others who have true expertise in this in their other lives are blanching a little bit, but it's not far off, and this is someone I trust who works for a large local Fortune 500 company, and that was the analogy he used. Yeah. That's not the way it works. So it's 4 years no matter how you slice it. There are certain processes that have to be done. We can't do it much quicker than that. And 4 years is a rounding. I'm sure, we're at 3 years, 11 months. I'm sure if we, really hustle, we're probably within the time frame where we could get it done, but I don't know by May if that's the case, by May 20th.
Mr. Chair, last question, Secretary Simon. So you have a project that has a particularly long timeline that we're bumping up against. We also have an election, as you've mentioned, that's coming up next year, right?
Right.
Do you have money that you are hoping to spend this year in order to protect our election systems next year? We know that we've been under threat of attack in previous elections.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Long, yes. We needed that money yesterday. And so anytime we have an election coming up, whether it's the March 2020 election or the August 2020 statewide primary or the November 2020 general election, we needed that money yesterday to do the things that we need to do to make the system safe. I would also add that many of the items on the list as part of this roadmap or menu were items that didn't originate with us. They originated as suggestions and recommendations from the Department of Homeland Security, who we had out to our office last spring and summer, a team of them, six or seven, camping out at our office, poking, probing, prodding, trying to find vulnerabilities. They wrote us a report, and they made recommendations. They're not kidding around. And these are things that they urge us to do, and we needed that money yesterday.
Thank you.
Representative Hertaus, do you have a question for the Secretary? Or?
I do.
Okay, Representative Hertaus, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Secretary Simon. Your comments about automatic voter registration and the change from opt-in to opt-out, I have a special concern about that with regard to the issuance of driver's licenses. This is a hypothetical, but should this state decide to issue driver's licenses to people who are not citizens, how does that improve the integrity of automatic registration with regard to who's eligible to vote and who is not?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus. That's a great and fair and important question. So I come to this issue with some personal experience. My mother was from Austria. She had a green card. She actually never was a citizen, and so she had a driver's license. Without getting too much into the legislation that you're speaking of, which is not part of this bill, but as I understand it, what would happen there is both physically on the driver's license, and I think what – I don't want to hijack your question, but I think what you were talking about is people not necessarily who just weren't citizens but who were undocumented here. I don't think you were talking about people like my mother who were here, documented and had green card holders. I'm assuming that's what you meant. But so both on the face of the driver's license and maybe more importantly in the system will be the words "not for voting." And as I mentioned earlier, this I can't say that this would change A to Z, but it would only change step A. B to Z would be the same. So if, for example, someone came in, to use your hypothetical, who was undocumented and applied for a license, that's why the name automatic voter registration is, I think, a little bit misleading. There's nothing automatic about it. Someone doesn't check the box, and then they're able to vote right then and there. They check the box, and then the process is set in motion as it exists today, so there would be the filtering and screening and checking. And we check, our office checks, every single voter registration in Minnesota against multiple databases, death indexes, Social Security information, Department of Public Safety information, so that would happen then. So the best I can say, without having the authors here and people from DVS, unless there's someone here from DVS to tell you that, is the same steps would be in place. But if someone who was undocumented applied for a license, what I can tell you, the piece of it that we own, is that person wouldn't be automatically anything. It would go on to step B. Step A would be changed, but step B would be what we have right now.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Secretary Simon, if the driver's license is not for voting, we don't require a voter ID to come and vote. So that really isn't a whole lot of comfort with regard to that issue. I'm concerned about somebody sitting in an office doing data entry that automatically registers somebody in the voting rolls who isn't paying attention as to whether or not somebody is truly eligible to vote. So by opting in, it's putting the onus and the responsibility on that individual and whether or not they're violating the law to try and register when they should be familiar with our laws and not be able to vote.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, you're right that human error can always be introduced, and that's just a problem in any function, public sector, private sector, whatever. I would say, though, that the same filtering and screening will go on. So if someone attempts to register to vote who shouldn't, those same processes would be in place right now. I would argue, and the reason that I'm excited about this prospect and other states have been is, you know, we can have an argument and have had in this room or rooms like it about same-day voter registration. There are some people maybe in this room who have some issues or questions or skepticism about that. And to those who do, I would say this is something you should want, because instead of 350,000 people on election day registering same day, where it's tougher to do the screening and the filtering and the checking that others might want them to do, now someone will be in the system not the day of the election, but the week, the month, or the year before. And I would guess, and I've said this to some of you before, and it's a rough guess, we would probably reduce the number of same-day registrants by probably 80 or 90% with this. It would probably be truly for people who literally just moved. Most of the rest of us would already be in the system. So all that checking and screening and filtering would be done not on election day, but the day, the week, the month, or even the year before. So whether it's someone that you described or anyone else, someone who's not from here, someone who has no business voting here because their true residence is North Dakota, or they're 17, or they're still serving a felony sentence, whatever the category of ineligibility, will be able to flag that much earlier. That's why I say, at least in my opinion, it would make the voting rolls even cleaner. But there's difference for room of opinion here, obviously.
Representative Hertzog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary Simon, for that answer. And I think the whole issue of these two things could be easily resolved and probably not have much pathway for resistance if we did have voter ID and if certain driver's licenses says not for voting on it. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, could you kind of, I'm not on the conference committee, maybe you could walk through your observations on what the holdup is. I believe that it's being categorized by several members around the table as somewhat partisan, if you could maybe help me understand that. Because, again, you know that I've been out with a concussion and haven't been following things that closely, but maybe you could help me with that.
Secretary Simon.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash. Well, as I mentioned earlier, and I should underscore again, this is not a partisan issue whatsoever, and the evidence is sitting around this table and in this room. You in particular, but others that I mentioned earlier as well, have been on this and paying attention to this for a long time, and the vote off the House floor here was north of 100 votes, majorities of both caucuses. So this is really more institutional than it is partisan. There's a difference between the House and the Senate. So I have, that's my chief observation, is that in the House, it's been a glide path to 100% authorization by people understanding that this is a national security issue and a very time-sensitive issue. So, no, I think in the first instance it's not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be. It's not a Democrat or Republican issue. It's a national security issue.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm hearing from others is that Representative Long has sort of hinted at that maybe the Senate is playing some partisan games, and there's some frustration with the fact that that this traditionally bipartisan, nonpartisan issue has been made partisan, and that's really sort of the launching pad for my commentary on this bill. Members, if you ran through the bill, there's 22 provisions here that are partisan issues, 7 that are bipartisan or nonpartisan issues, in a bill that has traditionally, including when Secretary Simon was then Chair Simon, when the assumption was that this would always be a nonpartisan bill. Our chair was on the Elections Committee. Chair Freiberg has served on the Elections Committee, and several others of you have been on there as well. And, it has been a 20-year tradition upheld by every chair that the bill that came out of the House would be bipartisan. Not bicameral, and the Chair Dean and I have gone round and round on this, but I'm always happy to do it again. I'm at full strength today, so the concussion hasn't slowed me down. But this has been a bipartisan bill that many of you have voted on. Many of you have praised Chair Nelson in the past, the fact that this was a bipartisan bill. What you see before you right now is nothing even close to that. And we even heard testimony and commentary from Mrs. Zavosik that people in the state of Minnesota expect bipartisanship, expect it, that they expect it. Representative Long mentioned that he was disappointed with the fact that the funding for cybersecurity was being held up because of partisanship. Representative Nelson, you said that you were confused, and you're on the conference committee, and you hinted at it being partisan. So here, today, we have this large bill. I've heard some people categorize it as the most partisan thing they've seen coming out of the Elections Committee in a long time. Others have called it fertilizer. And I'm just dismayed that this sort of bill is in front of us. And it's going to be rolled into the state government finance omnibus when it's always traveled on its own. So for those of you that are new, you probably heard a little bit about this coming in, that the elections bill is always bipartisan, that it's considered something that we all work together on. We're not trying gotcha moments, but we're here. We're looking at this now. You know, to the secretary, some of your provisions that you're advocating for are bipartisan, strongly bipartisan, and yet it's tucked in with stuff that even you yourself in years past I don't think would have allowed into the bill because it was hyper-partisan. Very disappointed in that. You know, we've tried a lot of things. We had a great night where we brought 60 amendments, and that was fun. But, well, for some of us it was fun. But this is not good work. For those of you that have professed your undying love for bipartisanship, well, guess what? This is nothing even close to that. Not even remotely close to that. It's loaded up with things that are very partisan, and to be honest, I don't know how you go back to your district and tell people that you came down here to be bipartisan having pushed this. You know, even things that I don't agree with are bipartisan. I'm not a big fan of the felon voting. I'd rather have taken a run at the sentencing reform and reforming probation, and Chair Dean and I have talked about that. I echo Representative Hertaus's concern on the automatic registration, and Secretary Simon, question to you on that. I'm not comfortable with just simply printing something on a driver's license that says not for voting. Can you help us understand the protections that if that were to become law, and I don't think it's going to, but if that were to become law, what are the data elements that you're going to be suppressing from the voter logs to disassociate an eligible voter from somebody who is an undocumented driver's license holder if that were to become law? Maybe you could help us with that, because I echo Representative Hertaus's concerns that that is a fairly dangerous provision if it's not dealt with appropriately.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I wish, and I don't know if there's someone here from DVS, but they're really in a better position than I am because we get the data from them. And so as we do with, say, people who are currently serving a felony sentence, that's a very good example because we also get it from the Department of Public Safety. There's certain checks that are in place, certain ways that it is coded or categorized in the system, but in the first instance, we take the data from them, we take the data from the court system. So when it comes to the criminal justice aspect of it, we take their data and we implement it, or we sort of add it to the SVRS, but they're in a better position than I am to answer the specifics of your question.
Representative Nash.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the Secretary, that maybe that's something we can address offline, but I'm sure it will come as a shock to no one that we should all be somewhat concerned about the veracity of data coming out of DVS, given their most recent track record on data integrity and systems that they have in place in general. So I am a little concerned about that. But back to the bill. Again, and I'll save some remarks for later, but, you know, I have concerns that there will be no elections bill. due to the hyperpartisan nature of this bill. It's a at the end of session that will become law. Chair Dean. 3-1. 3-1. 22-7, so we'll give it a rounding error. This is a partisan bill, loaded up with stuff that it's a dead man walking. And I got to tell you, it's disappointing that we are at this point, at this stage of the game, that someone didn't stand up and say, you know what, for the love of Lutefisk, let's do something that Minnesotans can be proud of and be a nonpartisan bill. If you wanted to run a partisan bill, run it solo. That was done in the past. But the elections bill has always been somewhat sacrosanct for three governors, Ventura, Pawlenty, Dayton. All of them said, so you've got an independent, a Republican, and a Democrat, all saying, you know what? Elections are so important to Minnesota, and it is such an important issue to them that they're requiring that this be a nonpartisan bill. And some of you around this table, I chuckled when you were talking earlier, Representative Long, at your frustration with an amount of partisanship coming potentially out of the Senate. But this is partisan. You've got provisions in here yourself that are partisan. So I guess I'm just mystified as to the morphology of this bill, because it is encumbered heavily with partisanship. But to the Secretary, since I'm ostensibly supposed to be asking questions of you, if you could help me understand later how we're going to ensure, if driver's licenses for undocumented were to become law, that Minnesotans around the state can have some comfort in the fact that we're doing our level best to make sure that those folks who are not eligible to vote are prevented from doing so, because I believe that you agree with that as well, that people who are not supposed to be voting in our system should not be voting. And yet I have great concerns, people in my district have great concerns, and people around the state of Minnesota have great concerns. And I just want to understand from you to a greater level of detail how we're going to make sure that happens.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I'm happy to have that discussion with you. As I said, I sort of need a partner here with the Department of Public Safety and DVS in terms of some of the nitty-gritty, which I understand that's where you live in that detail.
A little bit.
Level of detail, yeah, a little bit. And so I'm happy to have that discussion with you offline.
Thank you. Chair Green, did you have?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. And just to respond to a couple assertions by Representative Nash, I mean, I've just gone through the different provisions in this bill, and I did sort of trying to be like what is nonpartisan and what should be nonpartisan, and I was conservative on that. I think school board vacancy is a nonpartisan issue. I think restoration of voting rights has been proven to be nonpartisan for quite some time. Previously, the chair of the Republican chair of the Public Safety Committee actually authored that bill for several years. I think permanent absentee voters should be a nonpartisan issue. I think the presidential and national party primary is something that has been a nonpartisan issue. The election voting system, which expands electronic voting systems and certification, is a nonpartisan issue. I think elections by mail is a nonpartisan issue. Assisting voters in polling places is a nonpartisan issue and should be, and we would open ourselves up to a huge possible lawsuit if we don't change that law. Special election timelines, I believe, is truly a nonpartisan issue. The election security appropriation, which we've talked about, is nonpartisan. The election Hennepin County elections issues is a nonpartisan issue. Non-campaign disbursement for security-related expenses, a nonpartisan issue. All the stuff around the four provisions of redistricting, advisory commission has been nonpartisan issue, and I think the pure goal of that is to take partisanship out of our redistricting situation. And I think access to multi-unit residential facilities for our census count, if it's not nonpartisan, should be nonpartisan. So I come up with a very different math than what Representative Nash comes up with. I will agree that there are some things that have been painted as partisan issues, and we can paint anything here at the legislature as partisan issues. So I would just move forward that while he stated 22 of the provisions were partisan and 7 nonpartisan, when I do my math, I end up with 21 in a conservative attempt as nonpartisan, and only 8 that could be construed as partisan. So I just want to sort of give my perspective, because he gave his perspective, and I feel that at some point I have to respond.
And Representative Nash, when I said I was confused about the conference committee, I wasn't being partisan about it. I'm confused because we've made offers to them. The first offer was to meet halfway between their dollar amount and our dollar amount, give them the language they wanted. They turned that down. We asked them, okay, we give them their language and give them their money, but put a rider in it that before that or after the end of session, if nothing's been passed, that the money goes to the Secretary of State. They turned that down. We've made other discussions back and forth, and they've stopped returning our phone calls. And they've stopped. They haven't called meetings. The last time we called the meeting when we had the chair, had the gavel, they refused to show up. So that's why I'm confused. So Representative Nash, you had a...
Well, Mr. Chair, again, I want to paint this in an appropriate light that, Chair Dean, whether you agree with my math or I agree with yours, you've conceded the point that this is a partisan bill. It's got hyper-partisan provisions in it, whether you agree with my math or I agree with yours, and you admitted to that in my office when we first sat down to meet months ago, that there was going to be no expectation from your perspective that this be a bipartisan bill coming out of the House. You said that in as much as it goes through the Senate, it will then therefore make it bipartisan, and that's where the genesis of our argument about bipartisanship versus bicameralism came to be. So by your own admission, this has partisan provisions in it, whereas there has never been a place for that in this bill in the past. I find that regrettable, and whether your math is accepted or my math is accepted, the fact that you've admitted that there are partisan provisions in here is, while you will receive 0 Republican votes on this, which I find even more disappointing, because this has traditionally been, for those of you who that have been here, this has been the nerdiest, boringest, most boring bill that ever comes off the floor. And Chair Nelson was the minority lead on the committee and praised it for being nonpartisan, the last biennia. So let that sink in, members, that when you decide to vote on this bill, and we are going to request a roll call, so I might as well just do that now. When you vote in favor of this bill and yet profess your undying love for bipartisanship, that's somewhat contradictory. And I'll have remarks again later, so I'll go back on the list for wrap-up, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond. I was accused of conceding to the fact that I created a partisan bill. Our early conversations were my hope was to work bipartisanly. I stated that I was not going to not hear bills that I thought were important for the people of Minnesota. So when someone asserts that I've conceded, I don't think I've ever conceded on the record that I was out to create a partisan bill. So I just need to correct statements that are being made, because this is a recorded hearing, and when statements get made and people paraphrase in their own understanding of a conversation, sometimes the record needs to be corrected.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Secretary of State. One of the earlier testifiers, and I think I got the words correctly, if you can stand before an election judge, you should be able to vote. Is that something you agree with?
Secretary Simon. And I think that was, that's probably a little more, but Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I'm not sure, and maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention to whoever the testifier was.
Regarding who's
Secretary Simon had to do with the felon voting, and the testifier said, and I think they were maybe expanding a little bit, but if someone's standing there in front of you, they should be able to vote. And I think they were talking about the felon voting piece of it.
Oh, Secretary Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, well, an eligible voter should be able to vote, but no one else should be able to vote.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's what I was looking for, because one of the key parts is the integrity of our election system. For the early voting section, can a person register that day and do early voting?
Representative or Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, yes, just as in the current system.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically we have same day voting for, is it 31 or, you know, somewhere in the ballpark of about 30 days if this bill became law?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, actually under current law, you can vote and vote same day up to 46 days in advance. What this would mean is that the person can do what they can do now, only they can feed the ballot right into the tabulator rather than having to put it inside an envelope, which is put inside another envelope. So it's a pretty technical provision. But right now, if nothing has touched this session, current law is that up to 46 days in advance, anyone can both register same day and vote on the same day.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back to the election integrity, my understanding is that absentee ballots have certain, that process has certain election integrity processes added to it because, at least when it was originally generated, it was because on election day we have a very somewhat of extensive process to ensure election integrity, and that when you did absentee, we wanted to make sure there was that election integrity. So for these 46 days, and if this bill goes through, about 30 days, where a person would be able to run through, which means there wouldn't be the additional integrity processes that are in absentee ballots. But for those extra days, do we have absolutely the same election integrity and transparency and observability and election challenging and et cetera that happens on election day?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I would say yes, and that's why I say this is a really technical provision. We already have a rule in place, and I think it was former Representative Fenton's bill last session. We already have a provision in place where this same arrangement is in place for 7 days before the election. This was just take that same thing we have now with the no having to stuff a bunch of envelopes and extend it from 7 days to the provision of the bill. I think it's 30 days. So, yes, it's the same provisions. It just cuts down on a lot of hassle for voters and elections administrators, because what happens now is if you're on day minus eight, let's say, because former Representative Fenton's provision now makes it where you have this to day minus seven. But on day minus eight right now without this bill, you know, someone who goes and votes in person at a city hall or a county office has to take that ballot, put it inside an envelope. It's then put inside another envelope, and then you're handing it to someone who very shortly after that is just going to open up the envelope anyway. It's a little bit silly. And so that's why then Representative Fenton had that bill. This just extends what she wanted to do.
Secretary, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And apparently I misunderstood what you said, that they just have to open the envelope. Actually, they have to verify signatures, and there's a process they have to follow. It's not just opening up the envelope. And as has been brought up before, that in the absentee ballot period, there's actually less transparency and visibility for, you know, election day. You've got a process to allow challengers, and that was not, you know, allowed in some of the counties at least. And you're supposed to have two election judges during some of the processing and activities, and there were actual poll employees, people working in election process that brought that up, that there was only one, and they were told, well, basically they were kicked out of working with elections because they weren't part of the team, and that was part of a, of course, that was probably a federal elections complaint and investigation. When I look at the registering automatically and some of the processes, and when you get driver's license to people that aren't legally able to or supposed to legally be able to be here status-wise, and we make changes, I look at, other states that maybe have introduced similar processes. And in California, there were several thousand non-citizens that were registered to vote through their system. And you had mentioned that we've got all these checks and balances. We've got, we run it through the Social Security and other things. Over the last couple of election cycles, there have been tens of thousands of mismatches in that. You've referenced, well, some of these are run through more than once. Well, if you got over 15,000, each one that was had a mistake was run through four times, that's still 5,000, because that would be three mistake ones. And then the last time, all 5,000 were just, were passed. So it's still not inconsequential. And that's why I have some consternation with, the current process, because we still haven't heard what was determined on all those tens of thousands of registration mismatch or issued or flagged. You had commented when talking with Representative Nash that DPS is the one that, with this citizenship. Well, then why in the fiscal note are there funds listed for the Secretary of State's office for adding citizenship into the database? Can you clarify why that's not a Secretary of State's function?
Secretary Simon.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, yes, I can speak to the fiscal note generally and in particular to what you're talking about. Those are programming costs. Anytime there's any change to any field in SVRS, there is some time there. You'll notice, though, that for this bill, we are absorbing that cost. It's on the fiscal note. It's noted on the fiscal note, but we're going to absorb that cost. We're not going to ask that the legislature pay us more to do that. It's, in the end, not, a ton of money. We'll absorb that for the good of the team. But that happens anytime. And members who have been around and noticed this, anytime there's any change in the fields, there's just human programming costs that needs to be done to SVRS. Most of the fiscal note members that you're seeing here is not that kind of stuff. Most of it has to do with our office serving as the pass-through entity to reimburse local governments for the cost of special election. That's the overwhelming majority of this. So we don't get a penny of that. We're literally just the agent for you and the legislature and for the state to hold the money so that local governments can make their claims for how much it costs to administer those elections. So that's the vast majority of this fiscal note.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why didn't you answer Representative Nash when he brought that up instead of saying, oh, I don't see anybody from DPS? Because obviously you just admitted that changing that database, because his questioning, if I understand it correctly, was what systems do you have to prevent there from being someone that, isn't legally able to vote, which obviously if you're not a citizen, you can't legally vote. Because that falls in your purview, and you've just admitted that you were aware of that you had to do this and the DB. So I would hope that you'd be aware of additional checks and precautions that were involved, and maybe in the closing, Representative Nash can address that more closely. But, you know, frankly, if we in our current system don't have the data in the counties and Secretary of State's office through correspondence to me indicated that, you know, it's either not our job or we don't have the data or we can't do it, when queried about information on verification of all these mismatched registrations, and that's the current system, adding in this auto registration and driver's license that have is, you know, frankly meant to allow people that don't have a legal status here a driver's license, and that's a debate for a different committee whether to do that. But the side effect is that with auto registration, it opens up that possibility, and we've seen in other states that have this, where they actually have had documented thousands of non-citizens being added to the voter rolls from that. Those are the kind of concerns that I have in those sections. But I'd like to get your feedback on another part of the bill, which is unlimited assistance. There was an attempt to try and have it so that at least you had, if you're assisting somebody, basically a person that is helping to mark a ballot, I said that any person that is involved in marking a ballot ought to actually be able to legally vote. And do you have any opinion on that?
Secretary Simon.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Kwong, I think you're referring to the section of the bill that would, at least to my way of thinking, and as Chair Dean said, would avoid a big lawsuit for Minnesota. So this is the provision, members. Minnesota has a law on the books that limits to three the number of people that someone can assist in that matter in the polling place. So if someone brings their grandma, grandpa, aunt to the polling place, maybe they are limited proficiency in English, they can't then also help their uncle. They're limited to three. Only one other state in America, that's Arkansas, has any numerical limit of the kind that we have. And as I've mentioned in other committees, and but members here should know, we have already been contacted by a major law firm in Minnesota saying, in essence, that, you know, we're going to sue you. We're going to sue the state of Minnesota over this law. And this is based in part upon a 2017 federal Fifth Circuit decision out of Texas that said a similar restriction in Texas, not by number, but along the lines that you're talking about, Representative Kwong, violated the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act says that a person, a voter with a disability or a voter with limited proficiency in the English language, has the right to a person of their choice to assist them. And Texas had a law that said that the person has to be a registered voter in that county. And the Federal Appeals Court said, no, you can't do that under the Voting Rights Act. Choice means choice. And whether it's the person lives in the county or not or is registered or not, that's their choice of who's going to help them. You can have other rules in place, like they can't, you know, hijack their ballot and all the rest, but you've got to give them their choice. So by extension, what this law firm is saying is that in Minnesota, the numerical limit of three would deny that fourth person, technically, their choice. If their niece is the person they chose and their niece had already helped three people in the polling place, they would be denied their choice. So the way I've said it in earlier committees is, frankly, I think we can do this the easy way or the hard way. The easy way would be to repeal this law, which I have argued for years before we got the lawsuit threat, didn't make any sense anyway, it was bad public policy. But the hard way would be to get sued and have a court tell us hundreds of thousands of dollars later that we've got to take it off the books. So, I mean, I think that's the choice before us, and that's how I would characterize the issue.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, frankly, the idea of having someone that could legally mark a ballot, and there wasn't a specific restriction to number. There wasn't a specific restriction to you have to live in that city or district, but that you actually could legally, because frankly, you know, that the simple thing of saying no one that can mark a ballot can, you know, anyone that marks a ballot is a better way to say it, has to actually be able to legally vote. Because in that process, you have a better understanding of some of the parameters and the process and et cetera. And if I'm helping you work on a car, or help if somebody's driving a car, learning how to drive a car, needs assistance, it should be a licensed driver. They don't have to be from that town, but it should be a licensed driver. And I don't see that that would be a risk in a court case. But, you know, thank you for the enlightening on that. I frankly see a lot of opening for unintended consequences, a lot of opening for additional questioning of the electoral, you know, the electoral system, when we can't currently explain what's wrong with tens of thousands of registrations that are bad. And we're adding in systems that open up more risk for issues. And I'm basing that off on looking at states that have implemented similar laws and the problems that they've had. I have not been convinced by the testimony of the authors and et cetera that there are items in here to protect against. And I feel bad that the chair is frustrated by the conference committee, but in a discussion with the Secretary of State before we took up that bill, I had hinted that if you had some restriction that you first spent on the software or restrictions to where, you maybe remember the amendment. We listed off the HAVA things, and then we had a little line in, after that that basically said, and other things. And I just wanted to delete the and other things so that that would just be specific. Those funds would go specifically for those items that were listed in the bill that are related to HAVA.
And Representative Quam, we did take that out. That language was out of the bill. As it went to
and
conference, we took it out. And all the offers we made in conference, that language was taken out.
And it's restricted so that it's first spent on the software, and then once the software system is up, it will.
It was restricted to the stuff that was listed in the bill, the language of the bill.
So the first part of my feedback to the Secretary of State that first it be spent on the software project. And that was a priority, and then look at spending it on other things. Is that part of what the conference committees you've offered from your side?
Yes. Representative, we're running out of time here. 9:30, we're supposed to be done. I've got three more people on the list. So, Representative Quam, if you're done, you've had the last 15 minutes of asking questions and most of it you talking. We've got other people that have questions.
Do we have a availability? I guess we got that.
We come back at 9 o'clock tonight after the Secretary of State. We can find a room. But members, we're going to get done with this morning. So, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just quickly. Representative Nash had mentioned the bills that I had in here and referred to them as partisan. I'm not quite sure how he came to that conclusion. They are election administration improvement bills. They are supported by the nonpartisan organizations that testified today, the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties. If he means that they are partisan because they don't have Republican authors on them at the moment. That wasn't for lack of trying. I met with several Republicans and asked them to support the bills. They didn't object to the provisions in the bills. What they told me was that there wasn't going to be any elections bill coming out of the Senate, so why would they even bother signing on to a bill in the House? Which to me makes it seem not like a partisan issue, but an institutional issue. And I think that refers back to Chair Nelson's characterization of the institutional problem that he is facing in the HAVA conference, which seems to bear this out. Also, I think the history that you painted of the last 20 years of our elections bills and the legislature, it seems to gloss over a few things that I remember, namely a hyper-partisan constitutional amendment to try to restrict the voting rights for folks who didn't have a photo ID. That wasn't something that I recall being a particularly bipartisan issue. So the bipartisan, I don't think, can mean that folks can't come to the table even on reasonable election administration improvements. So I'm hoping that we can get to a point where we can actually have conversations about things that are supported by nonpartisan organizations and that are reasonable improvements to our elections without trying to block any reasonable election reforms. It seems like we are at this point.
And, Mr. Chair, just briefly, since I was mentioned.
Representative Nash, quickly, I'm not going to go this back and forth. We need to get...
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe the custom and usage is if your name is mentioned, you do get to respond, so I'm going to go and take advantage of that.
Well, Representative Nash... Representative Long from and put him on the list. So
we've now Nash exhausted longer than I was actually going to comment, so... But, Mr. Chair, Representative Long, as I had said, if you wanted to do something partisan, run it as a standalone bill, which was the case in the bill that you just mentioned. The elections bill, what we have in front of us, has always had the expectation of being bipartisan. So that's the case. Thank you.
Representative Green, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And something that hasn't been brought up yet is the national popular vote. And I will tell you that I have gotten more emails against this than the only other thing that came in with more emails against was when you tried to push the gun laws. Gun control laws, and so I would like a little explanation of this, because the way I read this, it looks like Minnesota could, for instance, vote for a candidate, and if New York and California come in and outvote us on everything, our votes don't count for anything, because we're just going to give all our electoral votes to whoever California and New York pick. Is this correct?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, California and New York will not be able to decide who the president is, although they have several much larger percentage of electoral college votes than other states. This still would require a group of states that meet the electoral college threshold in order to trigger a popular vote within the compact provision. So it would mean that states to sign into this compact, that should an individual get the majority or the largest percentage of popular votes, then this compact would kick in. The intent of this is to make sure that not just five or six states actually get coverage or presidential visits and work, because we know right now that it's five or six states that ultimately decide who the president of the state of the United States is based on electoral college. So this provision has been moving for several years, and again, it's a compact. We would join a compact. The compact does not get instituted until there's a majority of electoral college votes in that compact to move forward. So I think the notion of California and New York deciding who the president is maybe a little bit short-sighted and not quite truly representative of what this would do.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that is what's going to happen, because as the coalition grows, as the compact grows, then and they gain more power in electoral votes, then whoever gets the majority of the votes gets all the electoral votes. If that's the way I'm reading this. So, for instance, and this could essentially, you know, might people might like this. This could essentially do away with our two-party system. and we may have six people running for president, all right? And so depending on what our state rules are or guidelines, someone might not be eligible to be on the ballot in Minnesota, but they may be on the ballot in one of the other states. And if that person got 20% of the vote and everybody else got less than 20%, would our electoral votes then go to that person that was not even on our ballot?
Representative
Green. Chair Nelson and Representative Green, I believe that that is certainly a possibility. You know, your comment about a two-party system, we could have long, long debates on whether that's the best form of democracy for our country. And I'm sure that we would have many different opinions, probably as many different opinions as there are people in this room. You know, again, this is a compact. This isn't changing our system. It's just changing how we would pledge our Electoral College votes in the event that there was a national majority or maximum of the vote of an individual nationwide. I mean, currently the state of Montana, I believe, gets an Electoral College vote for every, I don't know, it might be 200,000, 250,000 people, whereas in the state of California, they're well over several hundred thousand. So when we look at the Electoral College vote, the weighting actually has a significant impact for lower population states. But again, I don't think we have time to begin to break down the different machinations and all these other types of things that will happen. I understand your concern, like you. I've gotten hundreds of emails about this, and I've gotten a few in favor of it. But there seems to be a resistance to this that's really well organized, and I certainly understand that, because I think the movement of moving to a national popular vote compact is well organized as well. So that's what we deal with here. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I'll just do a final comment, and we'll probably save our debate for the floor. But this is there's a lot of other things in here, but basically what this is doing, Minnesota has already trouble getting presidential candidates here. And because mostly because we're a blue state and they don't have to bother coming here anyway. But no matter how this goes, if our small state with our few electoral votes, if we're going to pledge them to the one who gets the most votes, we may not ever see anybody here because they're going to go where the population is. But like I say, Mr. Chair, we'll have that discussion on the floor. Thank you.
Representative Mason, quickly.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go on record. I, too, have gotten a number of emails and contacts about the National Voter Compact. And I wish there had been more time to discuss the validity of the Electoral College at this point in time. And my feeling is that there are more people that have been concerned or upset over the fact that we've had two presidents in recent history that have won the popular vote, but yet won the electoral vote, or the Electoral College vote. And so I will be voting for the bill. But again, I wish that Electoral College vote or issue had been discussed a little bit more thoroughly, or maybe got more publicity is a better way of saying it. Thank you.
And before I go to Representative Albright, who's going to be our cleanup here, just so you know, members, the HAVA bill that's in here, and if this bill gets put into the state government finance bill, it is my intent to take out the language in the HAVA bill on lines 48.21 and 22, the including but not limited to language that we took, that we've, and the offers that we've had in the conference committee. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, I'm just looking at the list that was provided to us of the various provisions that are in House File 1603. And just for a point of clarification, and if you could remind the members around the table, which of these provisions are currently traveling in the Senate?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, I'm not so sure any of these bills are currently moving in the Senate. I know that there are some bills that have been introduced in the Senate. I know that the Chair Kiffmeyer has a bill related to redistricting. I know that there are some things that are happening. You know, if I can take this opportunity, there was a question as to why these are going to state government. You know, the administration's bill of the Secretary of State has not even been able to get a hearing in the Senate. That's probably the most dry, nonpartisan thing that we've ever seen, but it hasn't gotten a hearing. You know, we were told early on that there may not be an elections bill in the Senate. I'm the chair of the Subcommittee on Elections. I felt it was my duty to put together a bill, and that's what I've done.
And Representative Albright, the Senate, their committee structure is different, and elections is in with their state government finances, so that's why the bill is going to probably end up in our, or parts of this bill are going to end up in our bill, because we're the ones that fund it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember a time back about four or more years ago when a very dear friend of mine, Representative Sanders, was the chair of government operations, and he was on the elections committee. And I remark about that from the perspective of what Representative Nash and others have shared with long-standing precedent. A precedent that, while Representative Dean, to your point, and others who have suggested that the bill contains, whether you agree or disagree with whether they are nonpartisan or partisan measures, at the end of the day, as I was witness to the process of the House file being put together with Representative Sanders, the reality of the situation is that the measures that were included in that bill that ultimately arrived on the floor by itself as a standalone had been arrived at through reconciliation and not so much compromise but agreement that this was a good bill that everyone could vote for. And I fear that that precedent has been broken. From the standpoint of that, the leadership from an independent, a Republican, and a Democrat governor have strongly urged both chambers to bring forward bipartisan bills that everyone could agree on. And until that was successfully accomplished, he, in the case of the three governors passed, would not be willing to sign that measure into law. And I fear that precedent has been broken. And Mr. Chair, another somewhat ominous, rather than omnibus, situation, and to your point about the character of the bill in the Senate, we don't do what happens in the Senate. That's their doing. But in the House, there's been a lot of characterization about single subject, about carrying bills that avail we as members to consider them on their own merits as standalone measures. But now we're going to put an omnibus election bill inside an omnibus state government finance bill. Again, breaking precedent. And I won't go into the strategy, if you will, about that, but I recognize that too is breaking precedent here. I will leave you with this. When Representative Sanders brought forward his House file on elections when he was the chair, he worked very closely with Senator Sieben at the time, and they had agreement. So it was a bicameral after it was bipartisan, after the partisan issues that were put in the bill had been reconciled, become bipartisan. And I'm not going to suggest that the Elections Committee or any other committee around this bill has not been cognizant of precedent But I do think that the work that has been carried by others in these chairs over past historical years has not been accomplished with this bill. And that is, I think, gravely concerning, and it should be gravely concerning to everyone who sits in these seats, because it does not set precedent very well for going forward. Mr. Chair, I have a question for you, and to the extent that you as chair have explained it already, but I'm wondering, you have noted that the re-referral for this bill would be to lay it over?
Mr. Chair, our Representative Albright, the motion was to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, and I would like to, as the minority lead on state government finance, I'd like to amend that re-referral and ask for a roll call that the re-referral be to Ways and Means for this bill.
Motion's been made to re-refer this bill to Ways and Means. I believe it's already went to Ways and Means because that's where it came to us from. But members, the vote roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
No.
Vice Chair Carlson?
No.
Representative Albright?
Yes.
Representative Acom?
No.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hertas?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keel?
Yes.
Representative Cleborne?
No.
Representative Lippert?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative Nash?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
The vote being 11 noes and 7 ayes, the motion fails. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to kind of highlight our party's concerns for this bill. Representative Dean, as you move through the process, I think you've heard our concerns. Fairly, rightly, wrongly, objectively, partisanly, or otherwise, but the staying power of an elections bill, as I have been witness to it in my terms here, has been that it has been strongly bipartisan as it receives itself to the House floor. And the gentleman sitting to your left has been a participant to those processes, along with such legislators as Representative Sanders and Senator Sieben, in coordination with these. And so beyond concerned. It's disappointing that we aren't working in a bipartisan fashion on this before it comes to this committee. I'm disappointed in the leadership that the executive branch of our government has not shown on this. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will close my remarks.
The motion was made. The bill is going to be laid over. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Albright, you had some questions.
I do, Mr. Chair, and this is more of a, you know, reminder of from an earlier conversation that we had, but with regard to two omnibus bills that have just come out in the last few days. We talked about, seeing bills that were at the core of state government finance and the budget that we put together. And I am sad to remark to the committee that yesterday in the jobs bill there is a section on page 30 that appropriates $654,000 to the Attorney General's office. We didn't hear that bill. Also in the Health and Human Services budget bill, there is a line on 261 of the spreadsheet for a transfer to the Attorney General of, starting in fiscal year 2020, of $213,000, moving to $263,000, and so forth. We did not hear that bill. We did not hear that conversation about funding for the Attorney General. Mr. Chair, with all due respect, you made the remark a couple nights ago that these types of finances are the backbone of the budget that we are intending to prepare. And I'm disconcerted, I'm dismayed that we were not either made aware or that we did not hear these provisions in this committee. And if we aren't hearing these bills in committee, I would ask that we hear the budget bills themselves, because how otherwise are we supposed to perform and execute our responsibilities as the backbone of the State Government Finance Committee to these outlays of taxpayer dollars on behalf of the Attorney General? I'm certainly welcome to your comments, but I'll leave it at that for now.
Well, Representative Albright, we've reached out to the Attorney General's office. We haven't heard back from him. Those bills we do not have in our possession, and my thought is to possibly have the Attorney General come in and explain those provisions to us on the bill, similar to what we did the other day with with House File 5.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your willingness to do that. I look forward to having those scheduled in short order.
Thank you, sir. With that, members, we're adjourned.